Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Hey listeners, welcome to Mormon Matters. This is Dan Weatherspoon, your host, and I'm excited to take this moment today to use this venue to share about an exciting project. It is a book that is coming out, a new tool for exploring and understanding Mormon women's lives and experiences. It's a book called Mormon Women Have Their Say, Essays from the Claremont Oral History Collection. And so certainly we're going to talk about the specifics of that book and what is an oral history project and the origins and the different types of things that went on there. But we're mostly using this as a chance to just say, what is it that's happening today? Let's destroy some stereotypes. Let's imagine a new norm for Mormon women, as this kind of projects will help us have a real better sense of how women are understanding themselves within the Mormon Church. There's always this temptation when it comes to, say, what do Mormons believe or what are Mormon women's like to focus on leaders? And one of the neat things about this is the lived, in the pew, experiential people, and a lot of new primary documents are coming out of this project. So I'm so thrilled to have the two editors of the book with us. First of all, Claudia Bushman, welcome back to Mormon Matters, and we'd love to have you just quickly reintroduce yourself to everybody.
Well, I'm Claudia Bushman. I'm a 19th century person. I do history and literature and American studies and women's studies and now Mormon studies, and whatever happens along is what I do. And one of the best things, my latest big chapter has been this oral history project.
Neat. And it began when you and your husband, Richard, he was the Howard Hunter Chair at Claremont Graduate University, and you were on the faculty as well during the 3 or 4 years that you guys were there?
That's right. We were there for 3 years. He was visiting Howard W. Henderson, Howard Chair of Mormon Studies. And he was visiting chair because they had not managed to raise all the money at that time. Now they have raised all the money, so that's a wonderful thing.
And so Patrick Mason is now occupying that chair, fully funded. So that's wonderful. But yeah, you guys were there and did some wonderful things. So we're thrilled to have you. And one of your students who's become your collaborator on this project is Caroline Klein. Caroline, would you quickly give us a little bit of background?
Sure. My name is Caroline Klein. And in 2007, I was a high school Latin teacher. But then I heard that Claudia Bushman would be coming to CGU to teach classes on Mormon women. So I quit my job and I enrolled at CGU. And 5 years later, I'm nearing the end of my coursework for my PhD in religious studies. My main field is women's studies and religion. And I focus on Mormon feminist theology and Mormon feminist communities.
That is a big change, all based upon an announcement.
Yeah.
Wonderful. And it's obviously worked out so well. What do you have to say about Caroline? Did you feel any pressure, Claudia, when you hear that somebody's quit their job in order to study with you?
Well, you know how it is with Mormon women. We're used to being on pedestals.
Did she remain there for you, Caroline?
Oh, absolutely. It's been such a pleasure to work with her.
But definitely, I'm sure, a very much more fully embodied person than the pedestal version. Yeah.
So, yes.
Well, so neat for you guys to have gotten together. Claudia, from what I understand, I've read around in the book, and I've read your introduction, and what it sounds like is the beginning of this project was simply a grant that was granted. What do you call it? A grant that was granted? A grant that sort of freed up some money that said, let's do something about women. And I'd love to hear about the genesis of how the whole idea of doing oral histories came about.
Well, that's true. It was a grant which we received from the Singer Foundation for $10,000. Diane Collister, who's now in the Mormon Studies Council, administers that foundation, and she said, do something for women. Didn't say what, and So I was really at kind of a loss at first, but thinking about the various possibilities, I thought this might be as good as anything we could do because it would be good for all the groups involved. It would be good for the students to learn about how to do oral histories, to feel comfortable with that process. It'd be really good for the people who were interviewed because it makes them think more deeply about their lives, makes them reconsider them and value the things they've been through. And then it's really good for the future because this is a project that I hope and I think will last forever and is inexhaustible in the things that we can do with it. So that's my long answer.
Yeah, terrific. And there's that piece in there about that makes them value their own stories, their own histories a little bit more. What is it about Mormon women, or is it just women in general, they don't quite recognize what they're doing is significant or that they're as much a part of an organization like the Latter-day Saints?
Well, it's certainly that they live in a culture of kind of secrecy and privacy, and they also live in a culture, a hierarchical culture, in which they're not very high on the totem pole. We all know that. I think Laura Ulrich says that there's one female biography or journal for every 10 men's journals there are. So, you know, it's really a rare species. But I see that changing. And, you know, it's women in general. Women live so much in their own minds, you know, particularly housewives. And they always feel there and they don't measure up. It's just a very unfortunate and sad thing. When they get together, they realize that they're not so bad. But when they're alone, they just beat themselves up all the time.
Yeah. Now, Caroline, did you happen to be one of the interviewees at some point? Did you sort of have a transformation in your own heart or mind as you did it?
You know, I was an interviewer, and I was also an interviewee.
That's what I meant, on the interviewee side of it. It was kind of this processing that LaClaudia is talking about. Did it kind of work the magic that she's saying?
You know, it did. I mean, I talked very frankly about certain struggles I've had as a woman in the Mormon Church, and I think voicing that and making sense of it in my own mind and seeing patterns in my own life is a very productive thing to do. So I definitely see what Claudia described there in my own life and my own experience with the oral histories.
Cool. And have you heard back from other interviewees that this has been like a significant and important thing for them to do?
Well, I have. Certainly they feel chosen in a very special way. And they usually thank the people that did the work on them, and with good cause, because it's plenty of work, isn't it, Caroline?
It is a lot of work. That transcribing process takes a long time.
Well, tell me a little bit more then, Claudia. How many histories were done? I'd love to know more about just how was somebody selected to be an interviewee and things like that.
All right. Let's start with how we chose people. Well, people chose themselves or we chose them. They were chosen by groups or by accident. If anybody said, I'd like to do this, but I'd really like to do my grandmother instead of this other lady, I say, fine. If they do their grandmother, that's wonderful. So there's nobody that knows all these women. Nobody knows them all. I mean, they just sort of expand outward in a sort of a, you know, the way lake circles expand. And they go farther and farther. We started out doing things in Southern California with older women. Very quickly, we were doing people who were younger. Very quickly, we were doing people in other parts, certainly in the West. And then we were doing people nationally. Now we're doing them internationally. I was talking to one of my connections today, who is a lovely young woman who comes from Croatia. Well, she's going to start a bunch over there. So, you know, it just expanded. That was one of the ways. Now, you also wanted to know how we chose them, what we chose them for. We chose them pretty much for people that would be just willing to tell their stories. They had to have a significant connection to the church, because we ask a lot of church questions.
Okay.
And they had to have, that had to be an experience, but they could be apostates. They could have, you know, that was all right, too. They just needed a connection. And then they needed to be willing to tell their own stories.
Okay. And what was the interview like? My understanding is it's almost like whoever is doing the interviewing is not asking them follow-up questions and things like that. It's like a set of questions, and then if anything, you're just smiling and nodding, but you're not really like taking it, you know, making them go deeper here or there, that kind of thing.
We do that some. I mean, I feel like I should have a conversation with them when I do them, because I feel I'm getting so much from this person. I want to feel like I'm giving something back. But I always edit those things out. What we want is their story.
Oh, okay, got it. So you do ask them and engage them pretty much, or is that just you, Claudia Caroline? When you did the things, were you similar? Did you like, oh, that's really interesting, tell me more? Or is it like this standard set of things and you wanted to just let them be on the stage?
Oh, I definitely did follow-up questions, and it was very conversational. If they shared a story, I might very quickly say I had a similar experience. Because like Claudia was saying, I wanted them to feel like this was a give and take, you know, that I was on their side. You know, I wanted them to have that feeling. So I was definitely very conversational when I interviewed.
Okay, but like with Claudia, mostly when interviewers did that, you would edit out those parts in the transcription process?
Yeah, all the questions were edited out. And all the responses by the interviewer were edited out as well.
Okay. So there was more than 100, I know, I'm trying to remember, it seemed like about 150, 160 that this book was drawn on. That was what the various authors of this book were able to look at. Is that right?
I think we're about 170 now. And then we have lots of them that are in the works. You never know if you're going to get them back. Now, when I was teaching the class, I could really put my thumbs on those people and make them do interviews. You know, I'd put pressure on them every week. But, you know, now those women have spread out quite a bit, so I don't have a lot of minions working for me. But I do ask a lot of people if they're interested in this project, if they'd like to write their own stories. And so I have lots of people that are doing that or are thinking they are going to do it or are thinking they're not going to do it. I don't count on any of those until they actually come in. I try and still do about one a month myself, but, you know, I just can't keep up with it because they've got to be transcribed. They're just so much more valuable if they're transcribed. So you do what you can.
Okay, so right now, let's hear a listener, and they say, I want to be part of this project. Do they need to officially find somebody that you have connected to it, or is there a way for them to get the questions and then just with a friend, or is it truly they can just write their own history? Because you sort of lose that oral history feel if it's them writing it.
Well, anybody, of course, is free to write their own history. If they want to be involved in art history, we kind of like them to either use this framework that we're using, which is the three things: biography, their own biography, their attitudes on certain LDS women's issues, and their experience in the church. And if there is anybody out there that wants to be involved, if you will just let Dan know. I have a hard email address, so I'm not going to give it to you, but let Dan know and he'll send me your connections and I'll write to you.
Good. That's wonderful. That's super great. Okay, well, so this is a ongoing creation of primary documents that will last forever. If somebody wants to take a look at what Mormonism in the late 20th, early 20th century is for women who are not necessarily leaders, I guess some of them are going to be more prominent than others, and the various issues. It was interesting to me to see what the different topics that were taken on in this book were, and so let's get into all that a little bit. But Caroline, is there any more descriptor of the project that you would like to interject at this time?
Well, I'll just say a few words about oral histories. I mean, Claudia said this before, that oral histories are just so important for women. It's a way that women are creating this new kind of history using their own voices and experiences. They're refusing to be kind of rendered historically voiceless, and they're challenging traditional concepts of history. So I think the very process of doing oral histories is just a wonderful way to acknowledge women's knowledge production and creativity. And I'm very excited to see oral histories at CGU expanding beyond Mormon women. They've now actually rolled it out into all sorts of other women of different traditions. And it's just a great way to affirm their experience.
That's cool. I hadn't heard that. That's neat. So you guys primed the pump for others. That's very cool.
Well, it was the dean of Arts and Humanities and Religion, Tammy Schneider, who actually wrote the foreword for us, who saw that this should be expanded, and she opened it to Muslims and Jews this year, And next year, Protestants and Catholics will be phased in. Now, how about that? So it was really something that the Mormons started at CGU, which is going to have a very widespread effect down the line.
Very cool. I'm excited about this project and of course the book, and it'll be, by the time this podcast out, it'll now be available on shelves. I think it's obviously available electronically as well. So those who want to read it will have a chance to do it. But mostly I just want to hear you guys reflect a little bit about first of all, let's do the topics that were covered. And in the course of just like mentioning this, again, I'll mention them, but if you have a story or something that really jumped out for you that's exploded a stereotype or that was really interesting or jumped out to you in the reflections on that topic, is that a good way to go to kind of, get the word out how groundbreaking some of this stuff is? Does that seem
sure.
Okay? Okay. All right, so first of all, you divided the book into three things: life cycle, life as a Latter-day Saint, and relationships with the institution. And Caroline, you ended up being the only author I can see here who did two of them, two of the essays about it. So you started with self and other as the lead thing. Was there, what the heck did you learn in just diving into self-identity and whatnot that maybe caught your attention?
Well, I was very interested in the idea of women's self-sacrifice, because in traditional theology, Christian theology, there's this idea that the typical sin for mankind is selfishness. But in 1960, someone named Valerie Saving, a feminist theologian, said, wait a second, that may be man's sin, but women's sin is the opposite. It's self-abnegation. It's self-denial. It's erasing yourself so that you become a zero. And so I was very interested in looking at these oral histories to see, does that paradigm work for Mormon women? Are Mormon women self-sacrificing themselves so that they are ultimately erasing themselves as human beings? Or are they taking a more flexible approach where they value both themselves and their own desires and their own dreams and the people around them? And so that was sort of the framing of the piece I wrote called Self and Other. I loved writing this one because it was so interesting to go through these women's lives and experiences and find moments where, yes, there were some moments of self-denial and self-abnegation, but ultimately what I found was a trajectory out of that mind frame. Yes, they may have been in that mind frame sometimes, but they always were able to get out of it. And in the end, they seem to have a very kind of flexible and nuanced approach to valuing their own dreams and also valuing relationships around them.
I want to read a quotation. Some of these women's words I just love. Now, here's a self and other quotation where a woman says, she was once silent, but she's begun to speak up. I used to think that my husband knew everything. I got married when I was 20 years old. After I had six children, I was probably 33 or 34 years old, and I still deferred most of the decisions in life to my husband. Our house was foreclosed on, and I realized that maybe he didn't know everything. I also realized that I had a responsibility in helping to make the decisions so that he didn't have all the blame. So that was a time when I realized my own selfhood and who I was, and I started to speak up a little better and a little more often. I just love this, you know. There's no anger there, but there's a taking on of responsibility. It's maybe a maturity that this woman has come to. I love that.
Awesome. Yeah, totally. I don't know if it's a sidebar or whatever, but do you think that the new mission age will help with something like that, that sort of deferral to husband, because there'll be more women who have had that experience of working with themselves, as well as the demystification of these Mormon missionaries as these super mature kids, the males? What do you guys think?
What do you think, Caroline?
Well, gosh, that's a good question. I mean, I would love to think that more women going on missions at 19 would mean that they see themselves as spiritually equal to their husbands. And I think that there's a good possibility that that could be the case for a lot of women. But on the other hand, as long as the church promotes certain ideas about men presiding, you've got something that will undercut that. So it'll be a matter of these individual women, you know, deciding how to balance that out in their minds.
Yes, I was at church recently when there was a Zone conference going on. Here were all these lively male missionaries talking to everybody in the middle of the room and making a lot of noise, and few little knots of sisters around the edges. And I thought, well, that's really going to be interesting to see what happens when there are as many women as there are men. And now in our ward, we only have lady missionaries. I think it is potentially, it is a great change. It is a great, wonderful thing. I mean, this whole business about all the girls, the young girls that I know that were going off to college this year are now planning to go on missions, which they were not planning to do before. And they'll be more mature. There'll be more missionary journals. There'll be all kinds of wonderful things come out of it, because there's going to have to be female leadership of some kind.
Right.
Or there'll have to be some kind of divisions, and there'll have to be chances for the women to get ahead. So I see it as a good thing. So I'm waiting to see.
Yeah, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful for that, for sure. Okay, well, let's. Okay, so besides self and others, is there anything more you wanted to say about that particular, how women are framing it? So in other words, if the stereotype is self-abnegation, you're saying that, yeah, that's certainly a piece of it, but what you've found in these histories is more people that are owning their own sense of identity and stuff like that. Is that a fair enough statement, Caroline?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I, you know, if you don't mind, maybe I can read you one of my favorite anecdotes. This is one I used at the end of the paper. And for me, it shows a woman really owning, you know, owning herself and moving out of a situation which was very bad for her. So let me read this. When I was 10 years old, my stepdad sexually molested me, and it continued for at least 6 years and overshadowed our relationship pretty much forever. It overshadowed how he treated my husband, it overshadowed how he treated my mother, and it finally resulted in him disowning me. I forgave him. I went through the whole forgiveness process. But after my mother died in 1994, he wanted me to tell him that what had happened was okay. He wanted me to acknowledge that my mother approved, and I knew she did not. I would not say what he wanted me to say. It was the final blow. I would not let him influence me. I did not need him, nor did I need that toxic relationship in my life. And so that crisis actually led to a wonderful thing in my life, freedom. Rejecting this brought freedom. I didn't have to tiptoe around like I was walking on eggshells. I became my own person. And I loved that little anecdote. I loved that last refrain, I became my own person, because it's this moment where she says, my health is important. My sanity is important, you know, and I am not going to let you manipulate me anymore. And she walks away from this abuser who had been in her life for so long. And so that was, for me, I think, emblematic of a lot of the stories about self and other that I was looking at. Women who were deciding, yes, relationships are important, but also my own dreams are important as well. My own health is important as well.
Awesome.
And I think that's wonderful, because this is the kind of, well, in this case, I mean, one of the questions people would ask me regularly is, what should I include things that are questionable? When I was abused by the Sunday school teacher, bishop, missionary, father, etc., I said, say if it's important to you, you should write about it. You should include it. But you don't have to tell all of the details all the time. But look how this woman not only names her abuser, which most of them do not do, but fights back and stands up to him, and really does come to terms. I mean, it's just horrifying how many of these women have been abused, and it's one of the reasons why people do not want their names attached to their stories, because they're still humiliated. They're still afraid of what it means. They still feel devalued by the experience. And you know, this gives them a chance to say it. And for the time being, for the next 10, 20 years, we're not using any names on these things.
Oh,
so
okay.
Nobody will know. Yeah, privacy is a big issue with these things.
Okay, so I'm seeing a name when I read the quotes, so-and-so said this, and it's, you were always given a first name. Is that not necessarily the person's first name?
It's absolutely not the person's first name.
Oh, every time it's not.
Yeah. So that was a big issue that we had in editing, publishing any of this stuff. So we decided that we would go with it.
That also means then somebody can't go hear the raw recording. It's the only access that the project's going to be making available is the published, approved kind of
That's
version.
Right.
Right. Okay.
The published version, and because we've got a book and we have to cite things, and when you cite things, they have to be available. Right. These materials will be in the libraries of the Claremont. The Claremont Library, is that what we call it? Mm-hmm. Anyway, they will be there, and within the next semester, they will be available in hard copy to read.
Okay.
But good. They will not be named. They're only numbered, and down the line, the numbers will have names.
Okay, so 20 years was just sort of an agreement with everybody, and could they renew their decision after the end of 20 years to not have their name attached?
Well, I don't think they can do it individually. No, we've got to do it as a group.
Oh, got it.
So but we're not talking about that down the line. They
okay.
still have tremendous value without names, maybe
right.
more.
Well, that life cycle one, Caroline, was also fertility, singlehood, motherhood, adversity. Those are hot topics. I've got a panel that's forming. We've kind of had some preliminary conversations. So we're going to definitely deal with fertility, infertility, and then, of course, the whole being single in a family church, and then the spectrum of things on motherhood. You know, I've got to think was just eye-opening. Any sharing from those chapters that just really blew your mind?
You know, I liked this anecdote from the fertility chapter, which was talking about how Mormon women dealt with issues of birth control, you know, say 4 decades ago, when it was actually kind of questionable. Like, Mormon women did not know whether it was okay to use birth control or whether it was not, because there were several messages coming from the pulpit that to use birth control was quite sinful. And so one woman talks about her journey in deciding how or if to use birth control, and her anecdote goes like this. Prior to our wedding, we received conflicting counsel. First, our bishop cautioned against the use of birth control and counseled us to let children come when they will, as he and his wife had problems getting pregnant, then lost a child, and finally had successfully had only one living child at the time of our temple recommend interview. Then our stake president advised us to prayerfully seek a safe method of birth control, his wife having given birth to 7 children very close together. He thought it wise to consider your wife's health and choosing your form of birth control. After moving to California following the birth of our first child, our new bishop was a medical doctor. He strongly recommended the use of birth control pill, stating that statistically it was much safer on a woman's body than pregnancy. The differences in these opinions was striking. I was never willing to use the pill, and we made our own decisions about having our family. So I think this was just a very succinct glimpse into how many different messages women were dealing with at this time and how they had to really make their own decisions about, you know, which leader are they going to listen to? Are they going to go with their own sense of what was right? And in the end, it sounds like she and her husband just decided to use birth control in their own way. And, you know, they had to own that decision themselves.
Yeah. You have to realize how much pressure there was on these people to have children and to have them right away. One couple that is in our sample, they married young, but they both wanted to finish school, and they didn't have any children until they'd been married for 5 years. And they got so much pressure from their ward, their friend, that her husband made up a number of answers. Why don't you have children? He said, oh, we don't like children. That was one thing. Another one was, well, oh, I'm sterile, which I expect went over pretty well. Anyway, you really did have, it was a defensive position that women had, since, of course, you don't have, it's illegal to even disseminate birth control information until the 1970s, if you can believe it. Roe versus Wade isn't until the 70s. So, anyway, it was a different world back there for people having children.
Right. And then, of course, you're going to get the contemporary stories with the women in their 20s and 30s right now who are infertile for whatever reason, and just how that's changing their perceptions of who they are.
Right. Sorrow, everywhere you look.
Well, you know, the part of the thing that we read in order to know that we're not alone? I think this is the kind of book that there's going to be certain listeners on all these topics. It's like, wow, I want to at least get a taste of what's in this project. And then at some point then, so Claudia, let's say that somebody who reads this and really connects with a particular anecdote, perhaps that abuse anecdote that you gave Caroline, they'll see the code name of the person. They would then be able to go read that person's whole history through a website right now, or would they physically have to go to Claremont?
No, they've got to go to Claremont. That's been one of the issues. And the library said that if we had privacy concerns, that we should not make online or whatever, you know, electronic versions available. We've got them all digitized, and eventually they'll be just streamed in with one thing or another. But now you've got to go read the hard copy. Or they can write to me. If they've got a good reason, I might give it to them.
Okay. All right. Thanks. So, cool. Yeah. All right. Good. Was there anything in the life cycle one that just jumped out at you guys that says, here's a stereotype that is going to be wiped away if people were really to experience these oral histories?
Oh, there's just so much good stuff. I forget things, too, but they really are some great things in this. Just almost makes me weep to think about it, to have all this stuff down, which otherwise would not be saved anywhere, or might be, but, I mean, there's so much that wouldn't be. Don't you think, Caroline?
Yeah. It is just a treasure trove. I mean, just glancing through the book, like quote after quote jumps out at me as being important and insightful. Dan, you were asking if there was, you know, anything else in the life cycle section. And I was just thumbing through the singlehood chapter right now. And I think this was a really important essay, giving voice to single women. And I thought maybe I'd just read a very quick little snippet from one single woman about her experience as a single in the church. And I think I love this because she's being so honest here, and she's saying hard things and things that she knows that a lot of people aren't going to want to hear or that they're going to be uncomfortable with, but she's saying it anyway. She says, I know that the church says it's for everybody, but really the emphasis is on families. If you're single, it's really just not the same. I guess it's kind of an inferior position. There are a lot of women in the church, and missionaries used to say that you have to convert the men because then whole families will join. Women are not quite as valuable. I know that's true. Women are not as valued. The men are needed to do the leadership positions. And as for women, you can fit them in anywhere or nowhere. And so there was something so poignant about this woman voicing her experience as a single person in the church. And I hope that, you know, if other people read this, you know, they can kind of keep this perspective in mind and realize that, you know, single women in so many ways are pushed to the margins and, you know, the importance of bringing them in as much as possible.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful.
I'll read another one quickly, if you don't mind.
Please.
Okay. My perception of women's role in the gospel is different from my perception of women's role in the church. In the gospel, I view the importance of a woman's role as equal to that of man, 100%. It's that simple. Not so in the church. I still think we have cultural issues between men and women. I believe women take more of a submissive role, consciously and unconsciously, in how they think of themselves and how they interact with men. I think in the church, women are utilized for their organizational skills, for service, for childbearing, for the growth of the church. That we have a way to go from an equality standpoint. But again, I think it's a cultural issue and not a conflict with doctrine. See, that's an example to me of what we see so much of the negotiating between churches' teachings and their own experience. You know, you have a lot of women who are creating doctrine for themselves out of this need to make a place for themselves in the church. I think the church is going to be driven to do something about women, but they're not going to be driven to it fast. Women are a drug on the market in the church. We have more women than we know what to do. They're wonderful, faithful, good women, and they just don't see the need yet to deal with their needs.
Yeah, wow. Now, in some ways, what you guys have both given us are relationships with the institutional church here. So we have life cycle stuff. And so in this case, for instance, the women different from the gospel to the church. Caroline, you did the patriarchy chapter as well, and that's in the part three of the institutional church. Is there anything that you'd want to draw on from there to kind of just continue a little bit more with this particular topic of women's lives in and out of an institution? And, you know, we always are focusing on the institution. So any more about just this, how you negotiate with patriarchy and structure like that?
Absolutely. Yeah. There are so many interesting ways that Mormon women negotiate and navigate these patriarchal waters that we exist in as women in the church. And so there were great stories of women, you know, trying to figure out how do they honor their leaders and, you know, in one sense do what they're supposed to do or what the leaders are telling them, but also how do they honor their own sense of what's right. And so I thought maybe I could share one anecdote with you, which was just terrific. And it's from a woman who was living in Hawaii in the 1970s.
Yes, I remember this one. Yes.
Yeah. And it was when the church had said, you know, no longer is Relief Society going to be financially autonomous. Now turn over your money to the bishop. And from now on, the bishop will fund whatever. And so this was the reaction of the women in her Relief Society. I'll read this to you. When the announcement was made about turning all Relief Society accounts over to the bishop, there was great consternation. Due to our earnings, we had a substantial bank account, but no particular needs for it, so it just built up to a large balance. The sisters said, "No, that's our money. We are not going to do that." I told them we had to turn it over. The reply, "All right, then we'll spend it." They decided to go into Honolulu to a nice restaurant and have an expensive buffet lunch. Two sisters were appointed to look over the restaurants in Honolulu to find the best buffet with large servings. I rounded up enough faculty women with cars who were willing to drive in and eat with us. The auto trip to the city was in itself a rare treat for most of the sisters, who had no cars to take them anywhere. They dressed up in their colorful muumuus with large hibiscus flowers behind their ears and draped with many strands of heavy shell leis. It was truly a great event for them. They had the time of their lives. Personally, I was embarrassed because they stacked up their plates so high that I feared the food would fall off, but they ate every bite. They each had some of everything, spent every dollar, and were very happy. So isn't that terrific? And it's terrific because they were finding a way to compromise. You know, yes, like they did not want to turn this money over to the bishop, and so they figured out a way to not turn the money over to the bishop. So I just love this sort of halfway measures, kind of navigating the situation that they were able to do in this situation.
Right. And that will not be in a general conference address as of our wonderful, beautiful sisters kind of thing, but it makes you love our sisters even more, right?
Yeah. Oh,
kind
yeah.
of thing. You're just people. Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. Well, okay. So let's quickly look back at part two, which is Life of Latter-day Saints. So we had womanliness, callings, revelation, and missions. The one on womanliness to me was fascinating. Do you guys, what were some revelations for you sort of on that idea of what it means to be a woman and what are the messages and all that?
Well, I would just say something about the way this book was put together. Did you think that those three divisions were clear cut and well developed? Maybe so. But we really put this book together with what we could pull out of people and then organized it from there. That one was actually written by Sherry Gavin, who is a friend of ours from Australia. I've never met her. Have you ever met her, Caroline?
No, I just know her online.
Yeah, we know her online. And she wrote me a letter one time and said, asked the question. I answered the question. I said, "Now, Sherry, you're down there. How about doing some oral histories?" And she organized a group of women who all turned out their own stories. And then she got wind of this book from someone, maybe from Caroline. She said, "I really wish I could be involved in that." And so we said, "Well, what would you like to write on?" She said, "How about womanliness?" And she found enough, and it was not our topic. It was the topic that she found. And then she actually wrote another one later, as you can see. She wrote the one on fertility. Is that the right one?
Yeah, and she was our hero because at the last moment she came through with that essay on fertility. We asked her about 2 weeks before we needed it if she was interested in writing it, and she pumped that out and got it to us, so we were very grateful.
And we were actually supposed to have two from two other people, but, you know, it's very hard to get these things
out
of the people into your hand. As you well know, Dan, you've worked with this kind of thing often enough.
Yeah, totally.
So, we feel very grateful that the book came together as well as it did. I was afraid for quite a while that we were not going to have enough essays to make a book. But I felt that we were going to go down below 10. But as you see, we really did pretty well. I mean, it was a good thing. Anyway. So I can't say anything about womanliness except I thought it was an interesting look at 9.
Okay, well, good. Well, Maybe this way. So let me just quickly read what part three was. It was the topics of agency, patriarchy, the Relief Society, Heavenly Mother, and California's Proposition 8. So that'll give a little tease to those who are listening of other subjects. So maybe the best thing for us to do as we wind towards a close, Caroline and Claudia, and that would be just like, what surprised you and what might surprise women who listen to this, what might surprise men who listen to this, what might surprise church leaders that listen to these histories? What if you guys were to summarize a little bit in terms of like, wow, my vision was widened big, what would be some favorites?
Well, I think that there will be many people, there would be many church leaders who would be surprised that these women are as articulate and have such strong feelings as they do, because many of these women are not women that speak up. I've been particularly doing those in my ward, and they are women that never speak in church. They're never called on to give talks, or at least not in my experience, and yet they have very firm and interesting opinions on lots of things. So I think that would be a surprise. I think the men would be surprised that the women are not more amenable to whatever they have to say than they are. You have a lot of people that are disapproving of things that the men do, as I can say, I've quoted that thing before. There's a lot of resentment in these things, but the women have pretty much decided to just go along and not make a fuss, because, of course, outspoken women have a bad name in the church, as you know. So I think they would be surprised at that. Other women would be surprised to find out that they have more sisters under the skin than they knew they had.
Nice. But
when you talk to any of these women and really get to talk to them well, you feel very close to them. That's one of the great benefits for me, that I feel so close to so many women because I know their secrets and stories. And people will be surprised by what's here. They would, because they don't speak the party line. They just don't. It's very seldom that you hear them say the things they would say in church. It's just wonderful to me, anyway.
I was just going to add really quickly, and one thing that I think people will love is just how nuanced women's perspectives on so many things are. Like Claudia just mentioned, the party line, that they don't always go along with the party line. I think in every one of these essays, you're going to find women who are very consciously navigating, different principles, and how are they going to manage this when they feel this way, but the church says this. And I think one very poignant story in the last chapter of the book, which is called Proposition 8, highlighted this very interesting nuanced position that women often take when they are pulled in different directions. For instance, this is from a woman who I think in the past has been a Relief Society president, so she's very integrated, but she also has a gay son. And so she had to figure out, how do I balance the fact that I am so involved in my church and I love my leaders with the fact that I have a gay son who wants to get married, and what am I going to do about it? And this is a little brief snippet of what she says. She says, "I often don't know what side of the gay marriage debate I am on. On the one hand, I believe that our son's marriage will be good for him and good for society. His marriage will in no way undermine my marriage or male-female marriage in general. On the other hand, I believe that a prophet stands at the head of our church that has spoken out against same-sex marriage. It's a good thing I have two hands." And that's the end of the anecdote. doesn't that give you a sense of like the complexity of the issues they're navigating, and how she's decided in the end, that she is going to be a support to that son and that marriage. And she stood by her son while he married the person he loved. And yet she's also very, very integrated into the church and believes her church leaders are inspired. So, how interesting to have to balance that out and to read about this in these oral histories.
Yeah, wonderful. Claudia, any more wise observations as the matriarch of this project that just kind of like, what just makes you so excited to get it out there?
Well, right along, I've seen this as an advantage for the students. And before we did these essays, we did presentations and conferences and did a lot of them. So all of our students that were willing have had experience now presenting in conferences. So we were trying to make these valuable professional activities as well as just regular schoolwork. So they all have resume items from doing it. They could all start a new project themselves, just like this. And now they've got a publication, which a lot of them haven't. Well, some of them have publications, but still, this is a very nice article and a nice book. And then we also see this going out and influencing people in the world. I mean, whenever I go places, I say, ask people if they're interested in doing this. And I find that we're going to have this wide sisterhood. It's going to be much wider than other. I mean, I go to things and I say, X, X, and X. They're all part of our oral history project. It's like when we went to a conference last week. My husband and I listened to two of our Claremont graduate students speak, and Richard turned to me and said, "Our boy's done good."
Nice.
That's the way we feel about it. I mean, here are our girls. They're out doing all these wonderful things. And our girls are not just our students, but they are all the women that they interview. And so, you know, I just feel like it's a rolling stone tossed into the ocean. Or I guess the lake is where you have to toss the stone.
Nice.
I want to read one more thing about free agency. This is from a woman. Now, one of the real problems of women as seen in this book, particularly in the missionary chapter, is that women feel terrible guilt if their children are not faithful to the church. The fathers don't feel it, but the mothers feel that it is their responsibility. But it is a very common thing for women's children not to remain faithful to the church. So here's how one woman dealt with that problem. "I so much believe that God meant us to have our free agency that while it would break my heart if my children left the church, because I believe it, I fully believe that they are here to have their own experience. I cannot have it for them. They're going to make their own choices. I relish the fact that they get to make their own choices. Hopefully I will have given them enough information to be able to say that this is something worth holding on to because it makes me happy. But if it doesn't make her happy, I can't and I wouldn't choose it for her. I want her to make her own choices." So, you know, again, terrible tension that women are dealing with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, beautiful articulation of that. Caroline, what makes you excited the most? What's left on your agenda here?
Well, in just big vision, I am so excited that this is another resource that gives us women's voices. One of my greatest sorrows as a practicing Mormon woman is that women's voices are so absent from curriculum, from sermons. And, you know, how can we raise our daughters to believe in themselves as spiritual authorities and leaders when they almost never see women around them, you know, raised up as such? So projects like this that create a cache of women's insight and wisdom are invaluable, I think, to women like me who absolutely hunger for these women's stories. And so I think this is such an important project.
Fantastic.
Lots of women just come and sit by themselves, as you know, don't say anything to anybody. But, you know, I just love the idea that one place I went, they said one of their rules is nobody ever sits alone in Relief Society. You know, you've always got a sister there that's got to sit beside you and talk to you. And I feel more of a sense of sisterhood among them. Now, one of the projects that was like this was done in a ward that was where my son was bishop many years ago in the Bronx, where they have many problems. And they also, because it was a cheap place to live, they had many missionaries. So they kept bringing more people into the church. And many of them were living strange, marginal lives. But they did a thing on the fifth Sunday in the ward, where they would have a little child's globe, and they would have three or four women who would get up and talk about their lives. They'd get out this globe and say, I'm from Madagascar. It's right here. And they talk about when their mothers were washing the clothes in the stream, and this two of these young American boys came up and started talking to them about another life and so on, how they joined the church, and they were able to get to this new world, and that's why they were there in America and what it meant to them and all. And it was just enthralling to see how people who had been total strangers became intimate. And that as the promise of this. And it does give you, if you can tell your story to somebody and that person values it, then you do have more confidence. You do value it more yourself. And everybody's story is worth valuing. I have one woman who, she's actually a person I visited and taught in California for a while, and she said, I understand you're a writer. I said, well, I write things, but I'm not a writer. She said, well, I said, what can I do to help you? And she said, well, you can write my story. And so I did, and it turns out that she's not only the daughter of Elvis Presley, but the daughter-in-law, I mean, not only, the daughter of Elvis Presley, the daughter-in-law of Marlon Brando. Well, how about that?
Wow.
That's a story. but she's got some evidence, and she told it with some great aplomb, and she's, anyway, people have stories. What I'm actually trying to say is, do I test these stories for truthfulness? No, I don't. I take what people have to say. We know that everything a person says is not what you would call truth, that truth is so elusive and impossible to get hold of that you could never relate it. By the time it comes through your mind, it's a representation of what was before. So it's what you can only do is record what people have to tell you, what they have to say. And they create stories as well as tell you stories. Having the reason to tell their stories helps them to turn those facts that they have in their minds into stories. They give them shape. They give them ways to react against their experiences. Some of these things that Caroline's been reading. You see people working with the facts of their lives. It's just a thrilling thing to me.
I love that.
Most histories of Mormonism focus on the institutional church. Its leaders, changes in practices and theology, major programs, major revelations, and so forth. And that's all very important and interesting, but a project like this that's examining the lived lives of real women, everyday women, women on the ground, women in the pews, this is really exciting. And I think it's right in trend with a lot of religious studies things right now, because lived religion is a big topic right now in religious studies scholarship, where they're saying, it's not only the organization that matters, it's really, everyday people's lives, their mundane realities, how they make sense of their faith, how they make sense of their spiritual lives. This is what's important. So a lot of scholars are actually really turning to things like oral histories and, popular religion, lived religion, to try to get into, how people are making sense of their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm thrilled about this project, you guys, and I'm just, this book is a neat thing, and it's the first peek. But tell me again, Claudia. Okay, you said if somebody wants to be interviewed, have them write to me, and I'll pass them along to you. Or tell me more a little bit about the process that they could expect at that point. If you kind of give them the information and they decide to run with it, what will be involved?
Well, most of them will probably have to write their own stories because I can't do too many, and I'm doing mostly local ones. But so if they're interested and they write to you and then you send me their names and addresses, I will send them the information, our little manual for writing your own story, which tells you all you need to know, more than you want to know. and I will also be glad to correspond with them, because I just value every story that's out there. And it's just a matter, it's a big job. It is a big job. It took me about a month writing a single space page a day to write my story. And that was with a few breaks and so on. And that's about what it takes. It takes about 2 hours to be interviewed if you're doing one of these things. And by then, everybody's exhausted. But If they will do that, then we will, and send me, they have to sign two documents. One is permission to use those words, the words that we've worked out together, that they have said, that we've edited and been passed back and forth. And they also have to fill out a contact sheet that gives us information on how to get hold of them. Those two documents, and we also send them one page of questions, which are quite general questions. That's our rule. You can't do more than one page. So we've revised them about 1,000 times, haven't we, Caroline? But sticking in one thing or another. But that's not what it needs to be. It can be other than that. You don't have to answer any of those questions. You can talk about other things that interest you instead. But we just are interested in covering voices, experiences, opinions, things, anecdotes, because they are so valuable in illuminating the lives of Mormon women today. And if somebody wants to do something really significant, they should sit down and write their own story. Then they should interview their grandmothers and their mother and their sisters and their daughters, and they'll be in a position to write a book like Before Zionists that talks about one family over the years, and it would probably be as great a contribution as they would make in the world. It would be just a wonderful thing.
Beautiful. So, now, let me ask one quick follow-up. You often use the language of write their own story, and yet this is the oral history project. Are you saying that in this oral history project there's room for people who sit down and as an act of the author's creation, they write their own story? Or are you, when you're talking about this writing, are they interviewed and then they transcribe and then there's some shaping afterwards?
Yes, we are certainly taking written versions. We did from the beginning because we just don't have enough interviewers to do it with all our people. But I actually like those better in some ways because you can say more of what you want to say at the time. You can go back and edit. You know, those are more finished by the time we get them. And we've also got a few that are ones that were written at where the person is now gone, where we were offered these stories and we took them. So they're part of our collection. They come in many forms.
Okay. Now tell me this. Is there an advantage? Okay, so let's say I write my story. Not that I'm a woman. So a woman writes her story. And she says, I'll include this at Claremont. Is there any rule that says that she cannot then publish it somewhere else herself as a personal essay or something like that?
No, it is no rule against that. We have equal rights to use those words. We can use them, but she can use them in any way she wants.
So she can out herself. She can out herself and her name from this project. In other words, if I've encountered her essay in, you know, some publication, and then I'm at Claremont and I'm studying through this, I recognize that obviously she's outed herself in terms of the anonymity. There you go. Right. So that's okay. So I'm just trying to gain. There's no loss in sending my oral history to the Claremont project. There's only the possibility of gain in that it's alongside a whole bunch of others that it wouldn't otherwise be.
I think we can promise preservation, because we will have the Claremont thing. We're going to put these things into other repositories down the line. They'll go to BYU. They'll go to the church archives, and they will be there. So, no, I think there's nothing to lose. We do, and if they want a wonderful Christmas present, I'll tell you one of the things. I interviewed my three sisters, and then when they were all done, I'd copied them all out and sent each of my sisters a copy of each of our four stories. And it turned out to be a real family page turner. Everybody learned things they didn't know. Hmm. So that's a real contribution. So you have another question. Go ahead.
Well, again, it is just this question of, so the Claremont project has no expiration date. You have this 20-year thing. There's not like a point 5 years from now that it'll no longer be able to go into the Claremont collection.
Well, actually, that's still open in some ways. I'm not sure exactly how things will go, but it will be preserved. Whatever is done, the projects will go on. And okay. Whatever is done will be preserved.
But right now, for sure, they would be in the Claremont project if they turned it into you.
That's right.
After following your protocols. Okay, yeah. Good. Caroline is a scholar on the rise. What has this inspired in you in terms of what you want to do and how you want to study religion and things like that? Is there something that just has this shaped the direction your own work will go?
You know, I think it has. Right now, I am envisioning my dissertation involving many of these methodologies, many of these techniques that I learned, you know, with Claudia doing oral histories. I think what I'll do for my dissertation is I'm planning to study Mormon feminist communities and go around to the various Mormon feminist communities all over the country, talk to the women, and no doubt I'll have my tape recorder, I'll be interviewing, I'll be transcribing, I'll be telling their stories, you know, I'll be analyzing. So I'll be doing all the things that I learned how to do with Claudia in this project, I will do for my dissertation. So it's absolutely been very important to me as a scholar and how I see my future unraveling.
You see, it's a win-win-win-win.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I am thrilled to have been a little bit of a helping with the launch of this book as it hits the public. And thank you very much, you guys, for being on Mormon Matters.
Well, thank you, Dan, for having us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Dan.
Well, good luck with everything. Listeners, please take a look at the book or just come and share your stories or reach out like we agreed. So why don't we just agree right now to have you just write to me at mormonmatters@gmail.com. That's an email that comes right to me. And then I'll work the putting you together with Claudia and getting the instructions and all that stuff. So I know that that's going to be a nice boost and some neat stories are going to come out of this. But do come to the blog, and Claudia and Caroline, I'll invite you guys to come to the blog and just kind of listen as people have heard this and reflect, and I'm sure there's going to be some questions that come your way, so I'll just invite you guys to the blog as well.
Great.
Thanks.
Thanks, everybody. We'll just wish you a good day and happy reading for all the listeners. Take care. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.